And now we have data. We have polling.
Mm.
We know what the public thinks. And so we've got the polls, then we got the politicians, and we got the press, because the polls stimulate the politicians. They go out with the polls, and then the press reports on everything. Angus Reid polling tells us the vast majority say schools should inform parents if children wish to change their pronouns.
Yes.
Well, the people have spoken.
You and I picked apart this poll a little bit because we wanted to know how it was done, how the questions were asked. And I think asking some good questions. So, it's by Angus Reid. And the first thing that I said is, sometimes people commission their polls and sometimes they just do them. So we took a look and it seems that this one was not commissioned. It was just done.
The relevance being that we're a bit suspicious of a commissioned poll because it opens the door for push polling where you could kind of I'm going to buy a poll. I'm going to phrase the question in such a way that I think I can anticipate the answer. And it'll come out looking like data, but really this was essentially manipulating a predetermined result.
Well, I have a really good insider story about push polls, because when I used to work at Assembly First Nation, that's exactly what we used to do. So we would phrase a question like, do you believe First Nations children should have the same access to education as other Canadian children? Now, that should be a dead yes. You wouldn't believe that 20% of people actually said no.
Yeah, but you got your strong majority.
But we got our strong majority.
You're leading people to, well, hell yeah, of course they should.
And we're asking that instead of should we increase money or funding to First Nations education, which would have gotten a bigger no, which is how you get equal access.
Increase the money. We give them enough money already. I say, so the same person who would say yes.
We already give them millions of dollars. Yeah. So it was meant to get that strong response. And then the second thing is when you sit there and you publish data like that, it becomes a news story. Just going out and saying it doesn't give the media any reason to publish it, but now there's a new poll out.
Yeah.
And so for all those reasons, so that was why we wanted to know, but they apparently did it on their own. Angus Reid did on their own, and probably on the strength of the movement, now coming into Ontario and these laws being in two provinces and coming into another one. The second question I had was, well, was it a random selection? Because you can do a poll and you can just ask your friends.
Mm-hmm.
If you go and ask how tall are people in the school, but you only ask the basketball team, you're going to get a biased sample. And so what you want is a random sample, which means, if you were doing a lottery and you put a whole bunch of balls into a bin, everyone has the same chance of getting selected, which mathematically gives you, a more realistic view of the whole. Another way to put it is if you're making soup and you want to see how salty it is, you can take a teaspoon. You don't have to drink all of the soup.
But what you're looking out for is gerrymandering, basically. If you don't do a random sample, then you can target certain sample groups that you suspect are going to go one way or the other.
Exactly. One of the things that has happened in polling since people stopped having landlines is that polling went through a crisis because they had a methodology that suddenly didn't work anymore. They weren't able to really tie people to regions. They weren't really able to get access to people in the way that they used to. So it messed up their math, and we had a few years of really bad polls around elections that you might remember. So how are they doing it now? It seems that they have a group that signs up that says, well, we're willing to answer polls, right? So they've gotten one. It's supposed to be random. It's supposed to be representative. But it's not really random in the sense that the type of person who's willing to sign up for a poll is probably different than your regular person. These are people who have strong opinions. So I think that there would still be some bias.
And time on their hands. This was not a commission poll. And I don't think that it was a poll that was specifically targeted at, this population or that. But one thing that raised an eyebrow was that it is this Angus Reid online polling. So, these are people who sign up to answer polls. So that either they've got a lot of opinions they want to share, they got a lot of time on their hands, or they whatever gift cards they get in response. I don't think that's the biggest problem with this poll. I think that the biggest problem with this poll is the question that was asked.
Mm-hmm.
Which, as we previously discussed, is, I think, the biggest determiner of what the answer is. So it sounds fairly straightforward. The question was, which policy do you prefer? Not sure? Can't say. Or, parents should neither be informed nor have a say? It's up to the child. Or, parents must be informed if their child wants to identify differently. Or, parents must be informed and give consent for this change. So I am not shocked that a strong majority of people chose either parents must be informed or they must be informed and give consent because of the way that the question was phrased. I think you could just have easily have asked a different question, and it might be the more germane question. You could have asked, if vulnerable children confide in a teacher and explicitly ask that the information not be shared with their parents, should the school be forced to tell the parents? Which is actually what's happening in these circumstances. And then I think the exact same people who said the parents have a right to know would say, well, no, if this kid is vulnerable and they're asking for, there's all kinds of reasons why a student might want to speak to a teacher in confidence and not have the parents know about
parents'
it.
Parents' right to know versus child's right to privacy is, I think, what you're getting about. The question asks about the parents' right to know. You're suggesting it could have asked and maybe should have asked about the child's right to privacy.
Well, and I think that most reasonable people would say the children have a right to privacy in certain circumstances, but not others. If it's about their drug use, maybe the parents need to know. If it's about, don't tell my parents, but I'm having an issue with how I'm identifying and I need somebody to talk to. Yeah, you don't tell the kid is telling you that this could have consequences for them at home. So I do think that this is a leading question that leads to a predetermined answer or an answer that we could reasonably say, like, we know where this is going to go. And then everything else just follows. Like, you know what the poll is going to say, and you know that Pierre Poilievre is going to pick that up and be like, see, Canada is with me, Justin Trudeau, butt out. And then, you know, headlines follow. Here's a tweet from Mel Wood, senior editor at Extra Magazine, a former and I hope future guest on this show. Here's what Mel Wood said. We need to call out this parental rights conversation happening in New Brunswick, Saskatchewan, Ontario, and likely more provinces for what it is, a dangerous anti-trans dog whistle. Don't think that Canada is different from the U.S. Our politicians attack trans youth here, too. Now, when we get to the press, I don't think the press has necessarily acted terribly, at least in the case of the Toronto Star. You would hope that the press would provide some of the context that we're trying to provide here, and I think the Star did. Gender identity pronouns in schools, Poilievre and others say leave it to the parents. Parents say they want to know. Here's what experts say. So without actually the Star weighing in editorially, they're like, well, here are experts on child safety telling you that maybe there's a reason to think about this differently. I think that's right. That's, you know, because it's fairly neutral, but it is giving you, like, there's another part of this that you need to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to, like, wipe the chalkboard clean and look at this in a different way, which is, like, this is about narratives to me. And there is a narrative. There's a story that is being told.
Oh, yeah.
It's a story that there is a radical woke agenda that teachers are in on and a part of. And that this radical woke agenda has a target on your kid.
I'm so glad you went there. That's exactly what I think, too.
They're trying to cut parents out of the deal, and they're trying to essentially brainwash kids into their weird gender ideas. And if you present a story that way, and if you constantly tell everybody, because that's a narrative that is going to have emotional reactions from, like, a lot of people, any parent for sure, is going to respond to that narrative. If that's true, everybody needs to be very concerned and probably get very angry if you think that it's true that there's this agenda and they're conspiring to cut you out of your, like, so personal, like your right to raise your own child. That is one narrative that, like, you know, is playing far and wide. And I think it's forcing people to think they have to choose a side. Like, oh, do you tell the kid, do you tell the parents or not tell the parents? But there's, like, another narrative that I don't think even matters to, like, the vast majority of people. But the people it does matter to, it matters a great deal, which is, like, for the very small, relatively, number of people, kids, who are experiencing these issues, you don't want to be, like, a football in this game. Like, there's a narrative that is just about you and your own identity and your own struggles and your search for supports. And I think that, like, rather than kind of, like, phrase everything as, like, which side are you on of this divisive debate, there is a role for us to just say, like, this is bullshit. This is not real. It's not the story is not real.
The story is not real, you know, but the problem is it's having real consequences. So, I mean, look, all kids go through trying to figure out their identity. They try to figure out, you know, if they're funny or if they're smart. And yeah, trying to figure out their gender and their sexuality is part of that. It always has been. Now they can use words and express themselves. And I think what you're saying about this narrative, I called it the rainbow scare, and I thought I had invented this, but I Googled it and CNN beat me to it. I believe it is coming up from the U.S. And not only do I believe it, as I was kind of looking around, there was a great article in Wired called The U.S. is Exporting Anti-LGBTQ Hate Crime that links conspiracies and these kind of alt-right theories, you know, these rumors that go around on the internet about there's a school that is forcing young men to dress as women. Like, none of these things are true. But it's trying to scare parents into the fact that schools are doing something to not just enable this, but to actually encourage it. It's to force it on kids. That's what the rumor is, that the teachers are somehow forcing kids who aren't trans to become trans. That is the rainbow scare that they're having. It was covered last year, but undercovered, that there were a bunch of people who were anti-diversity, anti-trans, anti-gay rights, who started trying to run for school boards and infiltrate school boards. And there were a few stories about it. It was being tracked by the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, but it kind of like stayed as an understory. And I think that all of this is coming up from like the real backlash against gay and trans people in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I found out through David Moskrup's Substack that the Freedom Convoy is planning their next move, the new convoy, and the new convoy is called hashtag Save the Children.
Oh, God.
So we should all be very, like, whenever you start to kind of mobilize this as, like, we're doing this for the children, won't somebody think of the children, like, be aware. But this is the grand unifying narrative that's going to, like, get the most people activated, angry, and emotional. And we need to be really cautious, like, about the narratives themselves, as opposed to just accepting these terms and saying, are you for this new convoy or against it? It's just like, well, is the basis for this even real? I mean, there's no shortage of these issues. The other big news, I think, on the kind of bullshit culture war story front is, like, here's a narrative for you that I think fewer people, but still a lot of people, are really responding to. The narrative that the powers that be, the establishment, the academy, the universities, and even professional groups like psychologist regulators are trying to stymie freedom of expression. That if some psychologist dares to say things that they just believe are true, and which might damn well be true, they will try to strip that psychologist of his title.
And I wonder who you're talking about.
And the courts need to step in and stop this radical woke agenda of the College of Psychologists. So this was in the cycle as well, and I think it's a related story, is that at a certain point, reality steps in to, like, assert itself against these narratives. Jordan Peterson, our reporting in 2018, Jonathan Goldsby was the one who broke the story that, like, this guy, when he became famous, started to do things that are not necessarily in keeping with what you would hope a psychologist to do. He started to publicly talk about one of his former patients in a negative way. And so if you're this guy's former patient, and this patient that was our source, she, like, lost him as her psychologist, and suddenly he's, like, going and giving speeches about this terrible former patient. And then he goes onto social media and says that, like, fat women aren't beautiful, fact, which is not necessarily something, it's an opinion. I think under free speech you can say that, but it's not really something a psychologist should be saying, and making jokes about how his ideological enemies might want to go and commit suicide. Not something that you want. If your job is to regulate psychologists, it's just reasonable. And then they have pre-existing policies. It's not about you suddenly have a woke agenda. You're like, yeah, we have rules about what psychologists should say out there because they represent the profession. And they didn't even say, we're asserting our agenda here and we're stripping you of your title of psychologist. They said, go take a social media course. Right? Because some of the stuff you're doing is not really in keeping with the profession. And he took them to court over that, and he just lost. So here's reality asserting itself. Like, no, nobody is out to strip you of your freedom of expression. It is well within the college's rights and responsibilities to ask you to go to social media course. But he's been going to town for years now that this is more evidence that freedom of expression is dead in Canada. And, like, we have to take note of these moments where reality is like, no, that was a false narrative from the start, just like your pronoun thing was a false narrative from the start. Yeah. Nobody was forcing you to use those. Nobody was taking you to jail if you refused to use people. Like, this is all bullshit. Like, the world is dealing with some real problems right now, and these distractions are given way too much attention. And, like, it's years before we just got to the bottom line of, like, we have institutions, we have the College of Psychologists, we have the courts. We don't need other institutions like Angus Reid kind of confirming and affirming, like, the entire country is being divided into this, like, oh my God, what are we going to do about this pronoun privacy issue with this? It's not real. It's bullshit.
Yeah, and I think that was actually, I point people to the Wired article. It was so good because it was really pointing out the important role that journalism is trying to play in sorting all of this out and just putting the facts in front of people.
Karen, our final segment today is about a disgraced pastor who was a bit of a celebrity in the megachurch world. And this is a bigger thing in the States than Canada, but Canada does have its share of megachurches. And this guy, I want you to picture him before you hear him, because without the visuals, like, how would you describe Bruxy Cavey? What does he look like?
He looks kind of like a folk rock star-y kind of guy, but a middle-aged one, you know, like sort of when they're past their prime. Long hair, old-styled 70s hat.
That's very reporterly. I would describe him as he looks like a guy who would sell you counterfeit Hoobastank tickets. He looks like the guy at the dispensary who would give you information that you did not request for about a half hour on the difference between resin and rosin.
He looks a little bit like Comic Shop Boy, but if he took up folk music.
Comic book guy in cargo shorts. I don't even think that's being mean. That's what Bruxy Cavey looks like. And here's what he sounds like back when he was still preaching.
I don't just read the book because the book guides me. I read the book to help me get to know the person, and he guides me. Christians are not just people of the book. We're people of the person. That's Jesus. And he comes to us in the form of the Holy Spirit. So I decided I'd get a tattoo to help me talk about this amazing Jesus.
This amazing Jesus. And he goes on to explain that he ultimately decided to get a tattoo of the passage in Leviticus where it tells you can't get tattoos.
Yeah.
I guess this is like stand-up comedy in the megachurch world. Anyhow, why are we dunking on, like, I don't mind speaking negatively about this guy because he is later being disgraced and accused by several of his former congregants, including an underaged member of his church, of sexual misconduct, harassment, and or assault. The church itself found in their investigation of this that he was guilty of harassment and misconduct.
Well, we're saying guilty, but nothing's been proven in court. But
yeah, I'm speaking specifically of the investigation mm-hmm. that the church ran, but there are criminal charges for sexual assault that he's now facing. And that takes us to our story today, which is that the complainant who has accused him of sexual assault, who we will not be naming and media has not been naming, but who was named online via social media and piled upon in violation.
We can say Alana. That was the pseudonym.
The pseudonym is Alana. We're in violation of a court-ordered publication ban. She went to court to ask a judge to compel Facebook, YouTube, and Reddit to disclose the user information, which they did. Where this is at now is the Toronto Star was caught up in a sweep. Bruxy's lawyers are trying to defend him, and they're gathering documents. And what would you do if you were trying to defend this guy against sexual assault claim is you try to discredit the people who are accusing him. And one of them spoke to the press. So what do? You try to get the Toronto Star's documents about this accuser. And once you got that, if you get that, then you can compare what she told the Star with what she told the court and try to find some minor discrepancies and destroy her credibility based on that. That's my, assumption as to why they want this material. They're trying to, it's a pretty safe assumption. They're trying to defend their client any way they can. That's their job. But we're supposed to have an independent press.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for there to be an independent press, the press is not supposed to hand over files about confidential sources to the courts. Toronto Star made an appeal to avoid having to give over these documents. The appeal was not heard. The application was dismissed on July 26, 2023. Karen, as a former president of the Canadian Association of Journalists, I know that you're really familiar with these cases. I am aware as a journalist that in Canada, I have to be very careful to never tell a source that I guarantee mm-hmm. their confidentiality. I can tell them, look, you will be my confidential source. I won't use your name in my reporting, but I can't promise them I will never disclose your name because I know that under Canadian law, it is conceivable that I would be forced to give the court not only their name, but all my files on them. Though I get a bit murky about, like, under what circumstances would I have to do that? And the only case history I'm aware of is the case of Ben McCoo, who I know the CAJ fought for him, and he ultimately lost. But that was a weird case because the source he was trying to protect, the name of the source was already known.
Right.
And it felt like more of like standing on principle, trying to not set a bad precedent. This case, well, all right, the source's name was leaked previously, but this one seems to me to speak directly to the precedent that we're most afraid of, which is how the hell is anybody supposed to trust a journalist with a story like a sexual misconduct story if the journalist might be forced to hand that information over to the alleged predator to destroy the credibility of the accuser? Like, that completely would, I would say, impinge, maybe destroy our ability to do journalism. I thought Justin Trudeau introduced laws after the Ben McCoo case to protect sources. How is this happening? How is the Toronto Star, like, so far they're losing?
Yeah. The way that I want to talk about this, I was actually just remembering as you were talking to me that the very first time that you interviewed me, the police had seized APTN's tapes. I think that was one of the interests that you had talking to me at that point. And we gotten the tape back. So journalists are not supposed to be an arm of the law. We go out, we cover protests. We talk to people who want confidentiality in various ways. If we are just simply turning over tapes to the press and to the courts and revealing our confidential sources, nobody's ever going to talk to us. And in fact, it puts us in danger if we look like we're narcs for the cops in some situations. So in order to get a tape, what the police are supposed to do is supposed to go through a very complicated process of getting a production order. So that is thing one. In the Ben McCoo case that you mentioned, they did get a production order. And the question there was just fighting over whether or not they should have access to his notes and the stuff behind the scenes. And
the source was dead in that case.
The source died, or they believe that they died. They found that out towards the end, and they went back and appealed and said, the source is even dead, and they were still told to turn everything over.
Yeah, so even though McCoo lost, it's like, well, you know, you're trying to protect your sources, your source, but your source is both, we know the name, and they're dead. So what are their rights to this protection? The fact that Ben McCoo lost that is like, well, I guess I maybe hoped against hope that, like, this isn't necessarily going to impugn our ability to work with sources who are living and trying to protect their names and their details.
Yeah, Ben McCoo, this was 2014. His source was a Calgarian who had gone to Syria to join ISIS, and the police initially said, we want to find out where he is, and so we want your notes. They fought it all the way up to the Supreme Court. They lost. Then, even though the source was dead, they forced them to turn over the notes anyway. But what they said in that case was that Ben had never guaranteed the source confidentiality. Mm-hmm. But it was still kind of like a shakeup for journalism, because it's very rare. Like, you're right, you can be compelled. And one of the cases when I was going through school that was kind of described as in a civil suit, if somebody feels that your source had malice and defamed them, your confidential source, you could face a court order forcing you to reveal that source. Because in the Constitution, all of our freedoms have limits on them. And so you run into these things like, where does the right to a free trial, when it comes up to the rights of the free press and they're overlapping, who gets the reasonable limit? In this case, what appears to be happening is you've got somebody who's saying, I need to have this information for a free trial. But what had happened in the meantime that hasn't had a lot of testing yet is the, you referenced it earlier, the Journalist Sources Protection Act, which passed in late 2017. It's not as high as the Constitution, it's just an act, but it gives a little nudge to the court saying, when you're considering press freedom and the limits on it, we've put out this act that gives you a little bit of direction to say press have a little bit more freedom in protecting confidential sources. So I would expect, and I'm not a lawyer, this is a layman journalist thing, but I would expect that this never should have been swept up into the pile in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's kind of coming down to is the judge is arguing procedure, and they're saying, wait and let the trial judge decide this. And the Star is saying, no, we do not want to hand over these documents to the courts at all. And we're drawing the line in the sand here.
Right, because this is not a case where the courts are compelling the Star to hand over the files to the accused lawyers directly.
No, they never do.
They would have to give the court these documents, a judge, as I understand it, would then assess them and see, well, what does the defendant have a right to have and what do they not have a right to have? And from, there's a legal question here that I'm not qualified to weigh in on. I think the courts are saying, let us see this stuff and then we'll be the judge of whether or not this should go or not. And any responsible newsroom would say, no, we don't give this to anybody.
Yeah.
That infringes on our independence directly. So you want us to basically defer to this higher authority and you'll decide what's right or wrong. But as soon as you cross that line and you know, the technicalities legally that this is at were kind of beyond our comprehension. We had as close as we get to a legal expert here is Jonathan Goldsby. And he looked at this and he said, it's highly technical and almost obnoxious.
I did call a few lawyers in preparation for this. And I'm usually pretty good at following what lawyers tell me, but my head was spinning. This is very technical.
It's probably
as simple for layman's terms that it's administrative procedure versus an all-out, this is journalism rights, we want a different procedure, we just want it to end now. I think that's what it's coming down to.
Yeah, I can't say for sure, but why I feel okay about talking about this is that no matter what the process is by which this is happening, if the outcome of this is that in a sexual assault journalistic investigation, a newsroom has to hand over their confidential files about an accuser to the courts, I don't think that's happened before. It's a terrible precedent. It affects every journalist in the country. So this seems to be like a real live precedent-setting case that I hope the Toronto Star wins. I hope they're in a position to fight. I think the press is weaker than it's ever been. You know, we used to see consortiums of reporters, of news organizations get together and chip in a little bit each for legal battles like this one because they affect everybody. But I do feel like in general, our rights are being eroded as we kind of get divided, minimized, and conquered. And you don't see the same level of resource from newsrooms to try to, like, uphold these precedents or stop these precedents from getting set.
Yeah, and it's kind of a good thing that it happened to the Star and it didn't happen to, like, a much smaller paper, because nobody except for the press freedom groups are really getting behind smaller papers when they struggle in these issues anymore, whether it's with the courts or whether it's with, you know, access to First Nations land actions. Like when it's the smaller papers, like the CAJ has been the only thing getting behind them, and CJFE sometimes. And those usually happen like on the cheapest level. It's usually a pro bono lawyer that's representing the press freedom groups, which people don't realize. Press freedom groups in Canada are all almost entirely volunteer organizations. And then the lawyers have to volunteer as well.
Yeah, there's like a group of media lawyers who kind of contribute pro bono work to this, and God bless them.
Yeah.
All right, so this is reporting is being led by Morgan Bocknick of the Toronto Star. The fight is being fought by the Toronto Star. Good luck to them. It seems to be also, we should mention, a confluence of the rape shield laws with source protection stuff. So this is a really interesting case. We'll be, I guess, reading the Toronto Star to find out where it goes next.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Shortcuts, Karen. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jesse.
We are on Twitter at Canada Land. I can be emailed about this at jesse@canadaland.com, and I read everything you send in. Karen, where can people find you?
They can find me here at Karen with a Y at canadaland.com.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Our editor-in-chief is you, Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you for supporting Canada Land.
The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, mad, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. email access@sfss.ca, or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.